Hey, good afternoon. Good afternoon. This is the Red America Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Cook. And if this is letting you hear me, then that means technology is working right for me. Joining me today is former White House and Treasury Department official Taylor Griffin. Taylor, how are you doing?
Doing great, Jonathan. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on, and thanks for bearing with me through technological issues. Hopefully, this is recording. So, what I wanted to touch on with you today is you, just a few months ago, you came off the campaign trail in a congressional campaign. So just to start off with that, how do you feel that went? And what, I know you had experience with Jesse Helms before. What do you think you learned being out on the trail?
Well, I think that's a great question, Jonathan. I mean, I think with our particular race, I wasn't successful. All incumbents ended up winning their races pretty much in throughout North Carolina because of the change in the primary date to June 7th, unfortunately, did not favor challengers, which was a frustration. But the but overall, I think it's been an experience that I would never give anything for. But one of the things that I've learned is just how frustrated people are with Washington and how frustrated they are with the way things have been going in this country and the lack of responsiveness. And I think career politics is primarily responsible for the situation that our country is in right now. We certainly hope to be able to do something about it by defeating an incumbent on our campaign, but that wasn't to be the case. I think that's still a problem, and I think that we really have got to look at some solutions to try to get new people into Congress that are more focused on what people in the real world really want, not what they want in Washington.
And your background is very interesting, and it's one that I got to learn about over the course of the campaign. Can you just talk about that a little bit, from the White House to the Treasury Department, and what exactly you did in both of those roles?
Sure. I grew up in Wilson, North Carolina, in eastern North Carolina, and when I was in college, I interned for Senator Helms. I originally thought I was going to go to law school, but I decided that I'd take a couple years off and go to Washington and work for Senator Helms, which I did. And I worked with him down at the Foreign Relations Committee where he was chairman. And that was a fascinating experience at that time. Clinton was president and Senator Helms was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee and an extremely effective chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. And from there, by hook or by crook, I ended up being asked to work for George Bush's campaign down in Austin, 2000. And went to the White House with President Bush, where I was a regional spokesman, and then the Treasury Department, where I was worked with the team on terrorist financing, dealing with the media and press, and eventually was a broader spokesman for economic tax policy at Treasury, and worked on Bush's presidential campaigns and the McCain-Palin campaign in 2008, and eventually started my own business, Hamilton Place Strategies, which is a public relations consulting firm, which I sold to move back home to North Carolina because I never meant to be in Washington more than two years. So the 13 years that I was in Washington was enough for me.
So that's an interesting background, especially in comparison to where we are now. What is your take on, I know you talked about terrorist financing, and that was your role in the Treasury Department. What is your outlook on the way that terrorism has evolved from even whenever you were in Washington to now?
That's it's much different now than it was then. We did a very good job after 9/11 of disrupting the organized terrorist networks of Al-Qaeda by cutting off its financing. And through our military action in Afghanistan especially. So the ability for terrorist organizations to act on the international stage as in a high level was very limited. And that's a remarkable accomplishment if you think about it. After 9/11, none of us nobody thought that 9/11 would be the end of major terrorist attacks on American soil. But we have not had a major al-Qaeda terrorist attack, certainly for the entirety of George Bush's presidency, and we have had some terrorist attacks during Barack Obama's presidency, but they've been on a smaller scale and with and a lot of them with sympathizers to ISIS and others. So what we've seen is sort of a decentralization of international terrorism, where groups like ISIS are depending on sort of self-appointed actors to carry out terrorism rather than it being planned from an international level. And I think that's a testament to how well we have been able to disrupt organized terrorism. But that still doesn't keep people from losing their lives and from terrible things happening. And so terrorism is a very different beast than it was 15 years ago on 9/11, but it's still a very dangerous element in our society and the primary threat to our security.
So how do you stop those lone wolf attacks that you talked about? Well, you didn't say the word lone wolf. You talked about ISIS sympathizers. I guess the first question is, are those truly lone wolf attacks? And two, if they are, how do you ever get a hold on those?
Well, it depends on which one which attack you're talking about, the extent to which they're lone wolf attacks. I mean, there were some that were clearly lone wolf attacks and others that had maybe a little bit more central organization and planning. The problem that we've faced right now is that technology, while it's been wonderful for all of us, has been a boon for terrorists in this kind of organization. You know, Twitter, Facebook, social media enable radical ideologies to reach much more broadly than they were able to reach before. And so there's not as much need to have your, loyal cadre terrorist army and get them into a country and have them attack. You can have people who are already in that country that you convert to your ideology and have them act on your behalf. That's a much easier thing to do. So it's been a big advantage. The thing that I think we have got to focus on more is twofold. First of all, disrupting ISIS in the region. ISIS exists because they claim to be a state, and their ideology claims that they're going to establish a larger state and eventually bring the world under the subjugation of Islam and jihadists. And so defeats of ISIS and the inability of it to call itself a state is a significant charge against its rhetoric. But the other part of it is, on the other side, to counter it, we have to counter the radical interpretations of Islam. And there are a lot of imams or a lot of mosques in the U.S. that are attempting to do that, to try to push a more peaceful interpretation of Islam. I also think we have to be very careful about the way we vet people who are coming into this country, either as refugees or as immigrants, to ensure that we're not bringing people in that are already predisposed to radical ideologies and could be dangerous. But it is a very, very difficult task that we now have in front of us, perhaps harder than disrupting an organized terrorist outfit like al-Qaeda.
I've always been, especially over the course of the past year or so, I've been very skeptical of the people who said that our number one problem was President Obama, Hillary Clinton, whomever, not saying the words radical Islamic terrorism. Over the course of the past, especially the campaign, I've been skeptical of that idea. That over the past 24 to 48 hours, especially today, with this attack in New York City, Hillary Clinton and her campaign, even though it is clear who this guy was and what his ideology is, still refused to even call it terrorism, much less Islamic terrorism. So now that I can kind of see it up close with one incident especially. Do you think that's part of the problem, that we have leaders in our country, especially in the foreign policy realm, who will not call it what it is?
Yeah, I think it is. I think there is a certain naivety on the part of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama about the challenges our country faces. Look, there's, if you look back at when Barack Obama first took office and he gives that big Cairo speech, it all goes back to this, that somehow if we just ask nicely enough, these people will no longer want to kill us and to subjugate us to their ideology. That's just not there is nothing that you can say that's nice enough to convince them that, oh, if they're convinced of a radical Islamic ideology that says that you have to fight the infidels by force, just you know, apologizing for America's behavior as Barack Obama did makes no change to that. In fact, it shows America to be weak. And that in weakness invites confrontation. When people feel like, people don't engage in fights when they feel like they're going to lose, as a general rule. And so when you tell people, no, it's our fault, it only emboldens people. And I think we've seen that with ISIS. And I think that attitude has led to some very poor policy decisions on behalf of the Obama administration, that's really given international terrorism a new breath of life. It's easy to forget that by the time Barack Obama took office, Al-Qaeda was pretty much decimated in Iraq and Afghanistan. Osama bin Laden was still alive, but he was in hiding and had very little ability to influence an international organization. But the decision by President Obama to withdraw from Iraq early, or at least to withdraw from Iraq before it was the right decision, enabled ISIS to be able to grow and to live out their dream of creating this mini state that is now inspiring terrorists all over the world. So by not admitting what the problem is, by saying that the problem is us, not you, you're validating the point that they're making, and you're only strengthening them. And I think that the Obama administration's refusal to admit that this is a radical Islamic ideology that is intent on the destruction of the West is dangerous. And it's not so much the words themselves, but the policies that they lead to that is concerning.
One of the biggest issues on the campaign has been terrorism, in what we've been talking about. And a lot of what you have said is what we've heard from people like Michael Flynn and Bob Corker going around as advocates for Donald Trump. With your background in terrorist financing, I'm curious what you think about his number one argument that taking the oil is somehow stops them in a sense. Is that an idea you subscribe to? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I actually do. And to the Obama administration's credit, they have stepped up attacks on oil shipments coming out of ISIS-controlled territories far too late, in my view, but they have done that. This is the big untold story of the war on terror, and there's a great book by my former Treasury colleague and White House Deputy National Security Advisor Juan Zarate called Treasury's War, about the effort to stop terrorist financing. But one of the most successful aspects of the war on terror was the fact that we were able to put together an international consensus to freeze bank accounts and assets of known terrorist financiers and terrorists themselves to prevent their ability to move money around the world to get resources where they needed to make attacks, and also to intelligence operations to be able to track money moving to terrorists or between terrorists to enable us to understand where terrorist cells were and to disrupt them. And so financing is you really can't mount a large-scale organized terrorist attack if you don't have the financing to do it. And no state, ISIS or otherwise, can survive if it does not have the money to pay for the organs of maintaining a government and a state. And so one of the primary means of ISIS financing itself has been sale of oil. And once oil gets out of ISIS-controlled territory, it's not like they mark it as ISIS. It's oil's fungible. It's all black. And so stopping the oil from getting out of ISIS territory and into the international market where it can be sold and they can make money off of it and use that to finance their activities is a very worthy goal, and the Obama administration should have done so earlier. The truth is that there is no fast, easy answer for ISIS. It's going to be a matter of I mean, you can't just go, what did Trump say, bomb the hell out of ISIS or something and solve the problem. The problem has got to be solved by incremental defeats against ISIS's primary argument that it acts as a state and that it can grow that it can fulfill their radical version of Islam, which says that the infidels will be put under the control of the Muslims. And to do that, disrupting the financing is important, but also defeating some of ISIS's strongholds. And I think we should be Syria's extremely complicated, especially because of all the bad policy decisions that led to the complications with Russia that restrict our ability to operate in Syria. But in Iraq, I think that support for the Iraqi army's efforts to retake control of their country, specifically now Mosul, is the target, and currently Iraqi forces supported by the United States are on the outskirts of Mosul. But we've been too slow to be able to offer that support, and as a result, this problem far, far more difficult to solve.
I'm curious to hear from you because of your experience. I know you follow politics very closely and with your background. If Donald Trump were to win the presidency, who are some names that you look at to fulfill his foreign policy, and in contrast, how do you feel about those names?
Well, I mean, I think you mentioned a couple of – you mentioned Michael Flynn, I guess, who's involved. I think that, you know, Donald Trump's foreign policy is certainly more strident about radical Islamic terrorism as than Hillary Clinton's, but it's also not a completely thought through foreign policy in a lot of ways. The international realm operates a lot more differently than domestic politics, and expecting a businessman to understand that off the bat, albeit it's very difficult. Now, I don't know who he would name as his Secretary of State or his Defense Secretary, but I think that the Trump campaign has a lot of catching up to do to really have a foreign policy for the United States that's going to serve our interests and serve peace in the world, which is our primary goal. And until he does that, he's going to have a lot of questions to ask. And I think that's why you've seen so many people in the foreign policy community endorse Hillary Clinton, unfortunately. And it's because she has a foreign policy that's, you know, more of a status quo, that's more something people could understand. With Trump, there's a lot of unpredictability in how he will approach foreign policy. A lot of people are very bothered by his approach towards Russia, for example. He seems to be a little naive about Vladimir Putin and other things. So I think that as he goes along, and especially in this debate we've got coming up next week, Trump's really going to need to show to people, to comfort them, that he really knows how to act as commander-in-chief and knows how to direct U.S. interests on the world stage, because that is the one area that the president has a substantial amount of power unchecked by Congress.
I'm curious. Obviously, you have experience in the White House. I think there is a divide between what the American people think the president's role in foreign policy and what it actually is. In your experience, what is that? I mean, how much does he have or she have versus Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Treasury, et cetera?
Well, all of those cabinet agencies work for the president. They're appointed by the president and confirmed by the United States Senate, of course. But the president is, ever since the very beginning of our country, has had substantial authority to act on behalf of the United States without interference from Congress. So first of all, the president constitutionally is the only person that is allowed to speak on behalf of the United States with foreign governments. If he's a legislator, you can go and talk to foreign governments, but you don't carry the weight of the United States. So foreign governments, the idea was is that they, when the founders kind of set it up this way, and this really kind of came to a head in the early days of the Republic with the Washington administration and the Adams administration. But you don't want to have other countries thinking they can go and negotiate with a bunch of legislators and go around the president. You need one person that conducts those negotiations. And George Washington was actually very adamant about that. And that's one of the reasons why treaties, are ratified, but usually with an up or down vote. So that's a really important role with the president, to make treaties, to appoint ambassadors, and to act on behalf of the United States. The president is also commander-in-chief of the military, and Congress, with the War Powers Act and other things, has ceded the president substantial responsibility for carrying out military operations on behalf of the country, without necessarily legally having to, in some cases, having to consult Congress, although presidents usually do for political reasons. And you're, of course, constitutionally supposed to declare war. Congress is supposed to declare war if we're going to have a real military action. But, you know, Congress is over the years kind of seen as has seen the importance of giving the president some authority to be able to act and to deal with a military problem that has to be dealt with before Congress can be consulted. So the president has a lot of authority there as well. And of course, the ability to appoint the defense secretary, the secretary of state, and the treasury secretary and others are very important. So the president has a lot of power and authority in policy that Congress can't do a lot about. A lot of the other responsibilities of the president you worry less about because you know that Congress will have to consider those and approve them, the economic policy and tax policy and that kind of thing. But in terms of foreign policy, that's a area where the president has a lot of wide latitude. It's always been that way.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, you were close to the Bush presidency. You viewed the Obama presidency from afar, I guess. What differences have you noticed between how they ran their foreign policy, just in terms of style, not as much substance and ideas, just what the, not really leadership ladder was, but.
Yeah, well, I think that first of all, there's probably been more similarities between the Bush presidency and the Obama administration than probably even Obama himself expected. You know, Obama, one of his campaign pledges that he was going to shut down Gitmo. That didn't happen. And one of the reasons is, you know, they still supposedly have a plan to shut down Gitmo or whatever. But one of the reasons is that actually served a purpose in getting into the presidency. I think President Obama realized that, you know, we really had to have some mechanism of dealing with people who are enemy combatants in a war on terror, although he doesn't call it a war on terror, but that's what it is. And so you've seen some similarities there. But the Obama administration has been very reluctant, has been characterized by a lot of half steps and by a lot of wishful thinking. So, you know, the Middle East will be peaceful and the war on terror will be solved if we just ask nicely enough. You saw that when he first came into the into office with the Cairo speech and the sort of apology around the world and withdrawing of American troops from Iraq, just assuming that just by pulling American troops out, everything would be fine. So he kind of sees it, I think, as that America is the problem, where George Bush always kind of saw America. He's an American exceptionalist in the tradition of most of the post-war presidents of the United States, and that America has a special purpose in the world, and that we're the good guys. And I think that's right. I think we are. Whereas Obama said, had more of a mixed view. Yeah, we're a good country, but you know, we're not always the good guys. And so he views America's power in the world differently. I think that he also as was elected to stop wars, not to start wars. But the result has been that he's been feckless in his response to a lot of national security threats and has in the process made them worse. Getting involved in Libya, for example, without a plan for transition of power has been a complete disaster. And it also signaled to the Syrian opposition that when Obama said that we can't stand idly by and watch human rights violations take place against innocent civilians, they assumed rightly in Syria that, you know, the same would apply to them and that if they rose up, the U.S. would be on their side. And in fact, a few months later, after we intervened in Libya, President Obama gave a speech where he declared that Assad must go. That cheered the Libyan opposition even more. We're going to have help from the United States. This is doable. And that's when the Free Syrian Army was founded. And then we declared a red line that Assad crossed and still did nothing. And what happened is we ended up kind of helping to stoke a uprising and rebellion in Syria that was premised in a lot of ways on the assumption that the United States was on their side and that we then abandoned them. And the result is that very soon after that red line was crossed and we did nothing, about 3 months later, 11 of the major opposition groups declared their allegiance to Islamic State. And we actually exacerbated the problem that we have with ISIS and terrorism. So, you know, the thing that Obama doesn't understand that I think maybe George Bush did much better was that you're either in or out. If you're going to get the United States engaged in a foreign policy situation, you have to engage fully because the world's going to look to us for leadership and that that there will be a lot of actions that follow on from that and consequences that follow on from the U.S. stating their opinion about what our foreign policy is. And unless we are willing, if we say something is in our interest, like removing Assad from power, then we have to be willing to follow up on that, and that we're not ends up getting people killed. And the result is 250,000 people are dead in Syria. So we should not have been declaring our preference or giving the impression to the Syrian opposition that we were going to be on their side if we were not going to do so. And so I think Obama's foreign policy has been this tendency to actually as The Economist magazine put it, a meandering middle way. He's always trying to find ways to sort of beat ISIS and project U.S. power without actually having to use the military, economic, and sometimes diplomatic tools that the president has at his disposal. And the result is that other countries judge us to be weak and unwilling and don't take us seriously when we say something's in our interest. And that's created a lot of chaos. And you've seen that with the way that Russia has tested U.S. resolve in the Baltics as well as in Syria, the way China has challenged U.S. and the interest of others in countries in the region, which depend on us for protection, in seizing South Pacific islands and building military installation on those islands, which will ultimately help them control trade routes. if we so it's a very naive foreign policy, and I think for people who've been watching foreign policy and been concerned about Obama's foreign policy, they're also concerned about Hillary Clinton's, and also concerned about Donald Trump. Honestly, there's not none of those. Neither one of the presidential candidates has really fully articulated a alternative to the way Bush approached it, which many people say was too interventionist, and the way Obama approached it, which is sort of this haphazard interventionism, to actually keep the world safe and to protect American interests.
We are all out of time. Thank you once again for coming on. You're the first national security expert I've had on the show. You have enlightened me. I know anybody who's listening is enlightened. Thank you for sharing your expertise, and we'll definitely talk again soon.
Okay, my pleasure. See you later.
Okay.
Thanks, Jonathan. Bye.